Hello and welcome to the Terra Nullius Cyprus podcast program. I've got a very special guest with us today, Mrs. Erado Kozaku Markoulis, somebody who I've wanted to have on the show for quite some time. Thank you and welcome to the show, Erado.
Oh, it's such a pleasure, Costa. It's a pleasure that we were able to arrange this meeting today, and I look forward to our very friendly discussion.
Thank you. Now, many people listening to the program now, to the podcast, I should say, will know who you are, and that's great. There's many that won't, but I do want them to get to really know you, take it to the next level. I've already given
I'm
you a heads
to
up.
Any question.
I know, and that's what I love about this, because I have the feeling we're going to have a really good conversation. Mm-hmm. So I want to jump straight back into the past. Let's go to your ancestors. Tell me a little bit about your parents and where they're from.
Okay. From my father's side, my father was a Cypriot, of Cypriot parents. He was a Limassolian, born in Limassol, studied in Athens, did also his specializations in Athens. He is considered one of the, among others, of course, the founders of medicine in Cyprus. Specialized in internal medicine and cardiology. He served also for some period as director of the internal medicine department of the public hospital in Limassol. And he wrote a book about his medical journey, which is very popular because it's one of the few books written. It's an autobiography, but centering on the establishment and growth of medicine in Cyprus.
So this was during the British period, correct?
Yes. He returned with my mother, and I will talk about my mother. They returned as a married couple to Cyprus in 1945.
From
Athens. Mm-hmm. They lived through the war and the difficulties of the civil war in Greece. So they returned in 1945, started my father's medical journey under very, very difficult conditions. He had to serve in different villages throughout Cyprus, from Arminu in Paphos to Morphou to Lysi. The whole family also traveled with him. So I always remember my mother packing our things and moving from one place to another. And she used to say that we are like gypsies.
And look, back in those days, without highways and good roads,
it was a big trip. It was really difficult. Okay, for us, me and my sister, it was quite traumatic because we used to make friends and then lose them and then had to start all over again. Finally, I think it was a great experience because we were able to live in different parts of Cyprus and experience the different ways of living and thinking and cultures of our country.
It's interesting what you mentioned, if I can just tap on that, where you said you're saying farewell to friends all the time. It's a curse and a blessing. You make new friends, you get to meet new people, but then at the same time you're farewelling them. It's a classic story of a migrant, isn't it?
Yes. We were like internal migrants. I meet a lot of people today, and they tell me, you know, we used to be pupils today in the past in that school, in that village, in that town. It's nice. Of course, you don't get to get into that deep friendship that you don't have the time really to make these friendships very, very strong. It was a great experience for all of us.
Well, everything's a lesson, isn't it?
From my mother's side, it's a very fascinating story, which I'm putting now in a book, which is going to be published, I hope, until the end of the year.
Wow.
My mother was of Pontian Greek descent. Mm-hmm. Both her parents, they descended from Trapezunda of Pontus. And her mother was born in Trapezunda, and the family left because of fears during difficult times.
Did they leave before the 22 expopulation?
Yes, they left at the end of the 19th century. Mm-hmm. Because every time that there was a war between Turkey and Russia, there were troubles, there were difficulties. When the Russians left, then there were incidents, violent incidents against the Greek inhabitants of Pontus. So at that period, I think it was during 1987, mm-hmm. that my grandmother, when she was 10 years old, they had to leave, and they went to Odessa. The family went to Odessa.
Odessa is now in Ukraine?
Ukraine, it is in Ukraine. There was a very big Greek community in Odessa. And in fact, my grandfather, he made business he was a businessman. Mm-hmm. Very successful businessman. So he had a business in Odessa already.
Okay.
So they went to join my grandfather. Now, on my grandfather's side, my mother's father, his father, so my grandfather from my grandfather's side, he was born in Trapezunda. He used to be a tailor of military uniforms for Turkish officials, soldiers. There was an incident, there was a threat for his life. The stories that my mother tells me, he went into a boat with some other people, and overnight they went opposite. Yeah. And when we say opposite, it was in Georgia, the shores of Georgia.
Okay.
So they went to Poti. Poti is one of the coastal towns of Georgia. And he established himself there. He started a business he had a family. He married to a Georgian lady my mother tells me now that it told me that she originated from a place in Georgia. There were a lot of, not kingdoms, but my mother told me that my grandmother, she had some roots in that place that originated from a princess family.
Wow.
That's not important, but I wanted to mention that.
That's fascinating. So the families, they've been in Ukraine, or which then would have been Soviet Union, correct?
Not yet. I'll talk about that.
I'm embarrassing myself now with my
dates. my grandfather, my grand-grandfather, he moved to Suhumi. Suhumi is another coastal town, the capital of Abkhazia. You probably know about Abkhazia.
Yes,
it's the district of Georgia that declared so-called independence, not recognized by
the international community.
Just a few countries. They moved there, and my grandfather was born. My grandfather was not born in Trapezunda. Mm-hmm. He was born in Suhumi. And he followed my grandfather's business. He was a very successful businessman, my grandfather. His name was Apostolos Tegmizoglou, but they Russified the names at that time.
Yes.
So he was known as Apostolos Tegmichov. He was a very successful businessman, and then he served as mayor of Suhumi.
Oh, wow.
Because there was a very, very strong Greek community in Suhumi, he served as a mayor. He made a lot of charitable donations, And I'm mentioning this because when communism came to Georgia, that was in 1921, although they were very rich, although they had a huge house with more than 20 rooms, they allowed them, the communists allowed them, because of the name that my grandfather had, to reserve some rooms to lend, to rent, and so they were able to survive. By that time, of course, my grandfather had died of illness. My mother was born in 1909 in Suhumi. And she grew up in Suhumi. She spoke Russian. She didn't speak Greek. Because my grandmother was 10 years old, as I told you, when she was she left Trebizond. How did they get married? The one from Odessa and the one from my grandfather from Suhumi. My grandfather was a widow with three daughters.
Wow.
He wanted to find a beautiful woman to get married again. He had some contacts with Greeks in different parts of the Black Sea, and he knew the family of my grandmother, and he proposed. He didn't know my grandmother, but she was only 16, my grandmother. Very beautiful, very, very beautiful. And in fact, one of his daughters was 15 years old.
So, all right.
So I have a picture of their...
How old was he?
He was 30.
Okay.
He was...
So he also had his kids young.
Yeah. No, he was 35. Okay. So there was a difference almost 20 years between them. So I have a picture of their wedding, and she looks like a little girl, you know, 16 years old. He was a tall man, a very handsome man, but she was just a little girl. Anyway, my mother was studied in Suhumi, and then she wanted to go for university studies, and despite her mother's concerns that she was going to leave the family, she went to Tbilisi, Tiflitha, and she started studying engineering. Can you imagine at that time?
Early
1930s for a woman. Because she was a very good student, and she went to this very famous school, which in fact was specializing in railroad technology. When she was, I think, in the second or third year of her studies, the family decided to move to Greece because there were... concerns, it was during Stalin's period, concerns that a lot of the Greeks would have been exiled to Siberia, to other parts of the then Soviet Union. My mother didn't want to leave. She was resisting, but finally she was forced to leave.
So, and this, your mother was Russian-speaking?
Yes.
Didn't speak Greek?
No.
Do you know if she identified as Greek?
Yes, yeah, okay. Definitely. They identified as Greek. She loved everything that was Russian. She loved the language. She loved the literature, the songs, everything. I grew up with the Russian culture.
Yes. Yeah. No, and I mean, it must have been a real cultural shock for her,
yes,
going to Greece, even though you identify as Greek, going to actual Greece,
yes,
which is a foreign language to you, even though you're Greek, and then coming from, you know, this communist state where you've been educated as a woman, you're living under, you're living under tense environment, as you said, the reason why they left. Where did they go to Greece? They went to Athens?
They went to Athens, okay, because they already had family there. One of... My mother's sisters, she left 10 years before, and one of her brothers also left to Greece. So they had a part of the family already living in Greece, but it was difficult. And my mother was always very, very sad because she had to abandon her studies. Oh. That was a trauma. Of course, they promised her that when she was going to Greece, she was going to be registered to the Polytechnic School and that she was going to be able to continue her studies, which did not happen. Because it was a period of dictatorship in Greece during Metaxas' time, we're talking about 1935, 1936, and everything Soviet was rejected. So her studies in a Soviet-ruled university was not recognized, null and void. So she, continued her life with this trauma that she was not able to complete her studies.
And she would have, I'm guessing, much like a lot of the Greeks of Turkey, Pontus, Minor Asia, Asia Minor, arriving in Greece, she must have been treated as a foreigner, yeah? Was she?
Yeah. Most of the Greeks that came from Asia Minor and Pontus, they were treated as foreigners. Because she was very good in what she was doing in the university, she was able to find a very, very good job in an industry dealing with heavy industry.
Okay.
They hired her as not as an engineer because she didn't finish her studies, but helping other engineers. Okay. But she was really good, and
she was at least in her field.
She was in her field, and she worked for 10 years, and she was the only woman.
Yeah, I was going to ask. That was my next question. She must have been the only woman.
The only woman, and wow. That was a great experience for her. Okay. So she met my father there in Athens. They lived in the same building, they were renting with my grandmother, they were renting a room, and my father was a medical student in Greece, handsome, Cypriot, very tender and very caring. So they got in love, and they ended up marrying in Athens, 1938.
What was the language between them?
By that time, my mother learned Greek. Yes, she had some intensive courses in Greek because that was the place that they were going to live. And in fact, my mother ended up speaking and writing excellent Greek. She was... she could express herself very well.
Well, it sounds
but
like
she always had an accent.
I think accents are hard to kick. Yeah.
A bit of an accent, in some words. You could tell that probably she came from some part of either Russia or Eastern Europe because of that accent.
Well, I think it sounds like she must have been a very intelligent woman to be studying in Georgia, to then learn Greek so fast.
Yes, yes.
Then meets your dad, and so they get married.
They got married, and then Second World War came. During the Italian occupation, my father was taken as a prisoner, along with other Cypriots and other some Maltese who were British subjects.
Sure, yeah.
So they were taken to a village in Etolo Acarnania, and they were kept there for almost a year. Wow. It was difficult conditions, but at the same time, my father used to practice medicine for free, of course, but the only reward was food from the local population. So they were able to survive. They were able to get along. My mother remained in Athens. Then, of course, the German occupation came. Very difficult times. all these that I'm telling you, mm-hmm. She wrote her autobiography mm-hmm. Before she died.
And when was that? When did she pass?
My mother died in 1996 in November, almost the day of her birthday.
Mm, wow.
And she left me about 190 handwritten pages in Russian. Okay. Yeah. So I had this treasure. I didn't know what it was. I didn't understand.
Can you read Russian?
When somebody speaks, I think I can get, you know, more or less the gist of what they're saying. But it was very difficult for me to read the handwritten.
Sure.
After she passed away, let's go back to the German rule. Very difficult times, hunger, poverty. My mother continued to work, going by foot about 10 kilometers back and forth every day. My father also continued to work as a medical doctor. But very, very difficult times. I have pictures from that period, and they were like Biafra people, you know, very, very deprivation and hunger for everybody.
Which is such a difference to where they started in their lives and to get to that stage. I mean, I think today's generation forgets the effects of this conflict.
Yeah.
I mean, we look at our world today being comfortable and modern and all the luxuries, and we forget how much that our own people suffered, let alone our neighbors today. But yeah, sorry.
What you're saying is true. And of course, this helped me to understand the tragedy of war, the tragedy and the remnants and the consequences of war, not only in the destruction of people, but also the trauma that they carry. And of course, my mother carried a very big trauma because they lost two of her brothers died in the First World War, and the other one committed suicide because he was injured during the First World War. The other one, the third brother, he died of typhus under very difficult economic circumstances after the First World War. So they carried a lot of pain. Mm-hmm. And of course, the uprooting from Trapezunda, the uprooting from Georgia. They were always refugees of a sort, and the difficulty of adjusting to new situations, whether in Georgia or in Greece, or later in Cyprus, because she had some early difficulties in adjusting to the environment of Cyprus.
I was going to say, and then yet again she becomes a migrant and comes to Cyprus.
Of course, and she was considered, in fact, as a foreigner, my mother. Although she was of Greek descent, although she spoke fluently Greek by that time, they thought she was, you know, this foreigner married to a good-looking Cypriot doctor.
Well, I think that to this day, Cypriots tend to be standoffish to others. So I can only imagine back then.
Yeah,
she must have been
the
fly in the ointment. You know? but to be fair, the one advantage she did have was to be with your father. So she had that comfort, I'm guessing.
Yes.
Now,
yes. But the trauma was there.
Of
the fact
course,
that, of course, let me finish about Greece and how they moved to Cyprus. So they stayed after the Second World War, after the liberation. Immediately after that, we had the Kevriana, as they are called, the civil war that started in Greece. Awful time. Awful indeed, because they lived in Pangrati, Athens, and there was the center of everything. I mean, everything that happened during that period centered in Pangrati. People lying dead in the streets, constant shootings and conflict and killings almost on a daily basis. And of course, they had to go to work. So she describes everything in her book, and I think it's going to be very fascinating when I publish it.
So you've translated her work, her writings into Greek.
So when she passed, I translated. In fact, the very beginning was I asked for a summary. Mm-hmm. Of a Russian woman speaking very well Greek. So I asked her to do a very good summary. Mm-hmm. It was about a 40 pages summary, because I wanted to know what's in the book, what's in this text. So when I read the summary, I said, no, this has to be translated fully, and this has to be published. I consider it a debt for my mother.
Yes.
And the reason that I am publishing it now is that I feel very strongly that I owe her to publish this.
Well, it sounds like, I mean, without knowing the content of what she's written, I'm sure it's going to be inspirational, even though I'm sure she hasn't written about herself in an inspirational way. But just the story behind it, what you've told me.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not going to tell you how to do this, but I mean, I'm sure there's going to be some introduction or something talking about who your mother is.
I did the introduction, and I have three chapters at the end. Mm-hmm. The first chapter, the introduction is about my mother, about her family, about the context where she lived. And the three chapters, the first one is generally on the Pontian Greeks, mm-hmm. because that's where she originated. The second one is about Trapezunda and the importance of Trapezunda to Pontos and to the Greek diaspora. And the third one is about Suchumi, where she was born.
Did she manage to go back to any of these places?
No, unfortunately, because it was when she died, no Soviet Union anymore in 1996, but she started suffering from Alzheimer 4 years before.
Yeah.
So when the Soviet Union collapsed, she started thinking about going back, visiting. In fact, she went to the Russian embassy several times. She wanted to arrange such a trip, but then Alzheimer's came and she
was already. It's a shame because it's much like Cypriots on the island not being able to go home for so many decades. I mean, Georgia, Black Sea region, they're so close yet so far. You know?
And she was in love about Suchumi. I mean, when she mentioned Suchumi and when she started telling us stories about Suchumi, her face was glowing. And
the nostalgia of her youth as well.
Nostalgia I remember always how passionately she spoke about her, she considered Suchumi as her,
her home.
Her home, yeah.
Have you been?
No, unfortunately, because of the very difficult political situation prevailing right now. If I go, I have to go to Russia, and then from Russia, because I cannot go to Georgia, for example, and cross.
Yeah, it's not like here. You've got to come from Russia.
It's not like here that you have the crossing points. Mm-hmm. There, it's not possible. Only UN people and so I have to go
via Russia. Like how they get to South Ossetia.
And because of my political status as a former foreign minister, for the moment I cannot do it, but I have to do it at some point. I really hope
you get to go there, because that'd be amazing too.
But I have people who I have a journalist living in Greece who. Goes very frequently there. He was born in Suchumi, and I have pictures of their house, my grandfather's house, of his business, where he had his business. Now, of course, it's The one, I think, is a journalist's union, mm-hmm. and the other one is chess association or something.
Of course.
Anyway, I have pictures of their home.
You didn't say your parents' names again, your father and your mother's names?
My father was Yorgos, George. Mm-hmm. My mother was Varvara, mm-hmm. but her Russian name, because they all had Russian names, was Varya.
Varya.
Varya is the Russian name of Varvara. So my mother was Varya. Mm-hmm. My father was Yorgos. My grandmother was Erato. Mm-hmm. I got her name. And, of course, I told you about my grandfather was Apostolos Tekhmichov. And I have, of course, my grand-grandmother's and grand-grandfather's names as well, which will be in the book with a lot of pictures. Fortunately, my mother had a lot of pictures from the family because it was a big family, and each one of them had pictures of their own.
And I've seen from time to time on social media when you share some of these pictures, and it's great to see because... I can see that you have a passion for your family. You have a passion for your ancestry and where you've come from.
And pride. Yeah, I feel very proud of my Pontian Greek descent.
Apart from being proud of your heritage, I think you should be definitely proud of what your family has endured and made it through the other end. I mean, not unscathed, of course, but it's... How they say, you wear your battle scars proudly. I think your parents must have.
Yes.
And they've certainly raised a very interesting daughter. So let's jump now to you and your sister, right?
My
two
sister,
of you?
She's 3 years older than me. Mm-hmm. She lives in Greece.
Okay.
She's an artist, but also a writer. Mm-hmm. She was a professor in a university for more than 30 years. In arts, she's a very good artist and a very good writer. She has been living in Greece since 1964 when she went to study.
Well, she also would have seen some very interesting times in Greece in the 60s and 70s.
Yes. So she remained. She married to a Greek. Has two children.
Mm-hmm.
One is an artist also, the girl, and her son is a journalist, a very good journalist.
Okay. And what was her first name?
Olga.
That's
but
right,
you
correct.
Used to call her Olya. Olya is the Russian
version.
So my mother used to call her Olya.
Is there a Russian version of Erato?
No.
No, okay. It's Erato.
Yes. But the other sisters, they had, for example, I had a... an aunt called Efterpi, and they used to call her Tepa.
Tepa.
But Erato, it was they didn't give her a Russian name. Fortunately.
So let's go to your younger days when you were studying.
Yes.
What did you study? Where did you study?
Okay. First of all, I finished my. Gymnasium, Lyceum. Mm-hmm. Well, we used to call them gymnasium then. We didn't have a Lyceum in Limassol. I was, in fact, the best student of all classes.
I'm sure you were.
1967. September 1967, I was a graduate of the Lanition Gymnasium for girls. We didn't have mixed schools at the time. I was wondering what to study, and I was advised that I didn't want to become a philologos, literature. I went to law school. I did my first degree in law.
In Cyprus?
No, in Athens. I went to Athens, yes. During my second year, of course, I got married. And my husband, I met him when I was 16.
Keeping the trend, keeping family traditions alive.
But it was, we fell in love in high school. He was in the boys.
See, they had you separate, but they still couldn't keep you apart.
Yeah, there was a fence. There was a fence between the two schools. But I met him during an event, a Christmas mm-hmm. event at our school. Mm-hmm. And, of course, he was very handsome, blue-eyed.
His name?
Yorgos.
He's also a Yorgos, okay.
Yes, Yorgos, George.
Yorgos.
We went to, he went to the army, then he came to Greece, and in 1970 we got married.
1970? 1970. Mm-hmm. And that was you're in the second year of university when you got married? Or that's
yes,
when,
yeah, yes, okay, yeah, the yeah. second year of university we mm-hmm. got married. And we continued our studies. He studied Bravo. Medicine. I finished my law. I got my law degree. And then because George continued with his studies, I did a political science and public law degree.
Wow.
Again, in the same university, mm-hmm. University of Athens. So I have two degrees from the University of Athens. And then when George graduated, and of course he had already a lot of contacts with Finland.
How so?
Because he was also the best medical student of all Greece.
Wow.
When he graduated. He already had offers from Finland, because there were some Greek scientists working there.
Mm-hmm.
So he used to go from the fourth or fifth year of his studies. He used to go to Finland and work for some periods. So he had this experience with Finland. And when he graduated, they offered him a scholarship, a very good scholarship from WHO, the World Health Organization.
Okay, wow.
To do research in one of the best laboratories in Finland. So I had to look around and see what I could do in Finland. In fact, they accepted me at the University of Helsinki
mm-hmm.
To do my PhD in
wow.
University of Helsinki.
So you must have been the only Greek Cypriot student.
Yes, no, we were the only Greeks at the time.
Yeah.
The only Cypriots, definitely. Mm-hmm. There was a very small Greek community. So mm-hmm. I remember when in 1975 Makarios came during the...
Okay.
There was a summit of the OSCE. At that time it was called differently.
Mm-hmm.
He asked the ambassador. We didn't have an ambassador there,
yeah.
but we had an ambassador in Moscow
mm-hmm.
who was covering Finland. So he said, is there any Cypriot community? The ambassador looked around, he asked, and we both, my husband and myself, we went to the hotel
yeah.
as... the only Cypriots living in Finland.
The representation of Cyprus in Finland.
Yes. So I remember that very vividly,
wow.
That we met with Makarios at his hotel. Anyway, we stayed there for 4 years, four and mm-hmm. a half years. My husband did his doctorate and of course, research.
What was your doctorate?
It was in sociology and political science.
Wow. Okay.
My thesis was... on the demographic transition of Cyprus, of the population of Cyprus, since the 18th century.
Wow.
I used every possible data that I had from the censuses, I did a lot of research.
That
really.
Can have been easy back then.
No, it was very difficult
yeah.
because we didn't have Google, we didn't have internet.
Well, this is what I say to everyone these days. Like, I mean,
it was extremely difficult, extremely difficult. I had to beg people to give me data, to give me publications. To be able to take those publications and copy them or read them thoroughly and then return them back.
Would you say that even back then, that being a woman, you would have had some pushback on, like, you know, why are you asking for this information? Why?
No. I didn't have a difficulty really. But it was difficult for people to... let go, you know, these, they consider them government mm-hmm. Reports, government publications.
Yeah.
Not many people at that time, they were pursuing doctorates and PhDs and so on. So it was not very familiar. They were not very familiar of what we were doing. But there were some people who really helped me in some government posts, and I'm indebted to them.
Oh, that's good to hear. That's until really good to hear.
Until today. They helped me to collect this very precious data on which I based my thesis. So it was demographic transition in Cyprus and social determinants of population development.
Okay.
So what social factors? So it was more sociology centered. But I have a lot of data in my thesis about the Greek Cypriot and the Turkish Cypriot population, mm-hmm. how it evolved, and what were the different social factors that...
Well, that sounds like invaluable information.
It's very, yeah. very... I was thinking of publishing it, but after so many years, you know, I defended my thesis in 1979, so yeah. it's a long time.
Well, I mean, it would have been valid until then, so it'd be good to share it. I mean,
and I think it's the only one that has been written about this issue, about this subject.
Okay, so anyone listening to this podcast can now be inspired to take the next step, start off where
you
left
English.
Off.
It's in English. Yeah. I typed everything myself on
the typewriter.
with tables, you know.
And they have AI to do that for you now.
It was difficult.
Yeah, I can imagine.
It was very difficult at the time. And I had to type my husband's also thesis because at that time he was not able to type. So I was the expert in the family.
Why was he able to type? He never learned to?
No, he was really busy. He was very, very, very busy with his research, thesis. I was less busy. Let's put it
I know that. I know from what I know of you personally, I know that you and George are very much in love and still are from back then till now, which
after
is amazing.
So many years, yes.
Which is not common anymore, unfortunately. Yeah. So that's really inspiring. And the fact that you were able to not only help your husband, but you actually yourself managed to get educated to the PhD level, you know, and to move on and do amazing things in your life. And have helped your husband in the process. I mean, the only words I can think of now is a jack of all trades, but good at all of them. I mean, I can only congratulate you and call you an inspiration to other, not just other women, but people in general and other Cypriots. So people understand what I'm talking about now. After you finish your studies, after you return to Cyprus,
after we finished our studies in Finland. Mm-hmm. George got a very, very good offer to go to the States.
Okay, yes.
So to continue his research, to continue his medical studies, he was already a doctorate. He had a doctorate from the University of Helsinki. So we moved to New York. Mm-hmm. My son was born a few months before we left. So he was 3 years old when we moved to the States. And
he was born in Helsinki?
He was born in Helsinki, yes.
Wow.
On his passport is
born
in Helsinki.
Probably the first Cypriot born in Helsinki, I'm sure.
And I remember his birth certificate was issued from the Cyprus Embassy in Moscow. Anyway, we moved to New York. I didn't do anything for 3 years because I wanted to be with my son. Mm-hmm. It was difficult times. I was all alone. I didn't have any relatives or anyone to support me. So for 3 years, I stayed with my son at home, a mom. I enjoyed it, of course, until he was able to go to a kindergarten. So he went to the Montessori kindergarten when he was three. And I was searching what to do. My husband was already established. He had also already some tenure at the university. So I had to start searching what to do in New York. And initially, I wanted to go to the UN as a secretarial, officer. But then I learned that there was an opening for a very temporary position at the Cyprus mission to the United mm-hmm. Nations. So I said, this is exciting. I mean, I will be representing my country. But that was for only 6 months.
Okay.
They told me not renewable contract. It was a contract basis. So I was hired, to help during the General Assembly in 1980. It was so exciting for me. Being in the General Assembly, meeting so many, having a chance to meet so many very, very important people. I saw, for example, Fidel Castro. I saw prime ministers, presidents of that time, from India, from Yugoslavia, from Soviet Union, from the United States. So for me, it was another university. My whole period for the 6 months. But it seems that I did a good job, so mm-hmm. they renewed my contract for another 6 months. I stayed under the status of contract. Mm-hmm. I was not an official diplomat.
Yep.
Until 1983, when there were openings in the ministry, I took the exams and I entered officially the foreign ministry as a diplomat in 1983. Until that time, I was working at the mission, but on a contract basis. So then my diplomatic career started. I stayed in New York in our mm-hmm. permanent mission until 1988. So I stayed for 8 years.
Wow.
I cannot describe this experience.
I can only imagine. It must have been exciting, educational.
And it was a period also of intense activity on the Cyprus question. It was a period that we had, it was the time of President Kyprianou, for example, and he used to come almost on every month with delegation from political parties, so I got to know everybody. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I was dealing with the Cyprus problem since the very beginning. So I have been dealing with the Cyprus issues since 1980. Different.
So you know something about it.
I know. I know a bit about it.
Well, let's
and I was there when major resolutions, when we talk about 541, 550, other resolutions adopted until 1988, I was there. I was mm-hmm. in the Security Council with our permanent representative, with our foreign ministers at the time. I was, in fact, involved in drafting the resolutions, mm-hmm. in amending the resolutions, so I have a lot of experience.
And I'm sure that from what I know when I talk to people, a lot of people aren't aware of your involvement there and how pivotal that was. Mm. I mean, we always hear about, the men in the leadership. We hear about Kyprianou and we hear about all the different leaders, but we don't hear about the people
behind the scenes.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to use the word the pen pushers because that's got a negative connotation, but the people actually putting ink on the page, and I know that you've been doing that. Let's go forward. Yeah. When did you become Cyprus's ambassador to Washington?
That was in 1998.
Okay, so we
returned to Cyprus in 1988 with George. I continued with the ministry in different positions, I served also as director of the permanent secretary's office. I was director of the Cyprus Question Division. Mm-hmm. Then in 1996... time, mm-hmm. I was offered to become ambassador to Stockholm.
Mm-hmm.
That was my first ambassadorial position. I went to Stockholm. I was covering at the same time, concurrently, as we say, all the five Nordic countries mm-hmm. and the three Baltic. So I had eight countries in my jurisdiction.
Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Finland, Norway,
Denmark, Iceland.
Yeah. So a very small region of the world.
But it was fascinating.
It must
really
have been.
Fascinating. First of all, it was a period that we were launching our EU accession mm-hmm, process. Mm-hmm. So I used to work very closely with the three at the time EU members from the Nordic countries, but also candidate mm-hmm. Baltic countries.
Yes.
They were candidates at the same time with us. So I had frequent trips to mm-hmm. these countries. Almost every month I was somewhere in these countries. And this is where I fall in love with the Scandinavian model, especially the social state and gender equality.
Yes,
global leaders. I became passionate about mm-hmm. Gender equality, and during my whole life, I worked both at the UN, then at the Council of Europe, on this very painful issue of gender equality, which unfortunately, we have not reached yet.
No, we have a long path ahead of us.
And as the Secretary General said many times, if we continue with the same pace and the same mentality, it would take another 300 years until we reach full equality.
That's at best.
At the best.
Yeah, yeah. No, and I think, we're looking at Scandinavia, which we've already said is a global leader in this field, and yet still there's work to do.
Yes.
So, I can only imagine in a place like Cyprus.
When you tell them, what you have achieved, they said, no, there's still so much work to do, for us. And then during my second and a half year as ambassador to Stockholm, I got a phone call from President Kleridis, and he asked me to go to Washington.
Now, you must have been the first and if not only woman to represent Cyprus.
First and only. And we were very few women at the time from all countries.
That was actually going to be my next question.
We were at the time when I arrived, we were six.
Six.
Only six women from all over the world.
In 1996, there were only
98.
My mistake. In 1998,
there were six women.
Only six
from
women
around the world
in
who
Washington.
Were female ambassadors.
I mean, were all six from Scandinavia except
no,
you?
No, no, no. There were some of them, they were from Latin America, mm-hmm. others from Africa. In fact, from Europe, it was me, the ambassador of Luxembourg mm-hmm. was. And then I don't think there was another one from EU or any other
country. I'm going to look up to see what today's statistic is like. But I wonder how much more.
Anyway, when I was about to leave, because I stayed for 5 years, we were nine. Mm-hmm. And a professor at the university in Washington, D.C., she published a book about us.
Okay.
It's entitled, go Google it and you will see, And Then There Were Nine.
And Then There Were Nine.
That was the title of the book.
Okay, no, I will.
And she talked about the female ambassadors.
Fantastic.
From a gender equality perspective, but also the how differently a woman can have an impact on diplomacy.
One image comes to mind which I absolutely adore, and for me it's so powerful, even though a lot of people may laugh, is the picture of you with President Bill Clinton wearing your traditional Cypriot foreshadi outfit.
Yes,
and I never forget the first time I saw this picture. I was interning at the MFA, mm-hmm. and I remember seeing this picture, and I remember thinking how powerful a picture, because often it would be a secretary or somebody in the lower echelons of an embassy getting dressed up in the cultural costumes.
I made it a point to wear the national costume, mm-hmm. even from the time that I was in Stockholm.
Yeah.
When we had the National Day on the 1st of October, I always welcome my guests at the embassy wearing. This was not an ordinary dress.
No.
I went to the Hirotechnia, mm-hmm. the Handicraft Society. Mm-hmm. And I told them before going to Stockholm, I said, I need two dresses, national dresses, one from Karpathia and one from Paphos. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to be made the original way, not this manufactured. I said, because I want to use it, I want to wear it, I want to be proud of it, I mm-hmm. want to explain to people what it is about.
Bravo.
So from that time, from Stockholm, I used to wear the uniform during the National Day receptions. Mm-hmm. And then when I moved to Washington, D.C., when I went to the White House to present my credentials, I presented them wearing the dark suit, as they asked us.
Yeah.
When I was in Stockholm, when I went to present my credentials to the Queen of Denmark, I wore my national dress.
Fantastic. I mean, I that for me exudes confidence.
I don't have a picture with the Queen because they don't take pictures. Mm-hmm. The royals, they never take pictures with ambassadors, only with heads of state. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you know about that.
Yeah.
But I have a picture entering the car of the protocol with my yeah. national dress to go to the palace. In Washington, D.C., again, during the National Day receptions, I used to wear the uniform, but also White House twice.
Mm-hmm.
At the White House, when there was an event for ambassadors, and they, in the invitation, when there was a mention about dark suit
mm-hmm.
or national dress,
yeah.
when there was this option, I would opt for my national dress. So I have pictures at the White House, and I have another pictures with Madeleine Albright mm-hmm. At the State Department also with my national dress. I always felt very, very proud of wearing our national dress. It was, for me, it was a way of telling people that Cyprus is not any country. It's a country with a lot of culture. It's a country of a very long history. Mm-hmm. And I was very proud about that.
It doesn't just simply exist.
No,
there's more to Cyprus than
it's the IAM. So, of course, there were some journalists at the time, Cypriot journalists, that they
made a mockery
yep, about me. But yeah. I never
look at them now. Yeah. Look at you now. I mean, we have now in front of me. I have Erado, who sat on the negotiation tables in. I've just lost the name of the cities in Switzerland. In
Montpelleran and Crans Montana.
Montpelleran and Crans Montana.
Before I was a foreign minister.
Sorry, I keep jumping ahead because I know the answers.
Let's go very quickly. Yeah. 1910.
Mm-hmm.
So sorry, 2010. President Christou. No, before that, 2007. Mm-hmm. President Papadopoulos, when there was a departure of the Akel people from the government, mm-hmm. And there was only about 8 to 9 months remaining until the end of his term. He asked me to become the foreign minister. So in 2007 until February 2008, mm-hmm. I was foreign minister for the first time. It was a very difficult time because...
also the first and only female.
Yes, first and only female mm-hmm. Foreign minister so far.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my first short tenure, but quite difficult.
Key years
mm-hmm. after the Annan Plan, there mm-hmm. was a lot of criticism and so on and so yep. forth. So I tried to help with my diplomatic experience to overcome mm-hmm. this criticism and establish a better image, which was tarnished, unfortunately, during the referendum, after mm-hmm. the referendum. By the way, this is not the first time I'm saying it, but I voted yes during the referendum for the Annan Plan.
Mm-hmm.
Although I was at the foreign ministry at the time, I was not a foreign minister, but I thought it was a very good opportunity, probably the only opportunity that we had so far to reunite Cyprus before entering the European Union. Mm-hmm. Anyway, then in 2010, President Christofias offered me the Ministry of Communications and Works mm-hmm. at the time. Now it's Transport, mm-hmm. Communications and Works. Yeah. So I stayed in that position until August 2011, and President Christofias offered me the foreign ministry because there was a reshuffle again. Some of the ministers left, so I became a foreign minister for the second time, 2011. Until February 2013. Mm-hmm. And I had the very, very important experience of our presidency of the Council of the European Union for the second part of 2012. Yeah. Mm-hmm. A remarkable experience. We did very, very well.
We did. Cyprus made itself proud at that time.
The first presidency we ever had. Mm-hmm. A small country, and we made it.
I think the only thing that went wrong was that Vladimir Eleftheria wasn't ready, but the rest of the presidency was fantastic.
But we had all the important roads, for example, highways finished, the renovation of the airport.
I remember it was a pivotal
major
time.
Works,
it was incredible. And I mean, also, Mr. Andreas Mavroyiannis did a great job in his role.
All did. I mean, it was not Mr. Mavroyiannis alone.
No, of course not. But I'm just
all the ministers, really, all the ministers, they
Everyone
worked very
their
hard.
Hands
and
out
all and, the public service.
Yeah.
And not only the public service. But we took it upon ourselves that we had to work very, very hard.
It was basically our version of the Olympics. I mean, it was one of the biggest things that ever happened on the island.
Sure.
And I believe it's coming up again relatively soon.
2025 or 26.
Yeah,
if I'm
it's
not mistaken.
Coming up again.
Yes,
so, like,
yes.
I mean.
Anyway, that was my second tenure as foreign minister. And then in 2014, President Anastasiadis asked me to become the head from the Greek Cypriot side of the Working Group on Property.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
By the way, I was the head of the Working Group on Property from 2008 to 2010 during President Christofias' time. So I continued in that capacity during the negotiations. And then in 2016, I became a member of the negotiating team, not only Working Group on Property, but also of the negotiating team.
Just let me take just one step back, because I think people should understand.
So we are almost at the end of
the property, and we're coming close to the end, indeed. People need to understand that the property chapter in the negotiation is one of the thorniest because it affects the most people personally. Most people don't understand laws and treaties and territory and, you know, air and energy and all these issues. But property is something that people feel personally. Hence why it's such a sticking point. So that's such a, shouldn't be underestimated. And I know that you went through some very difficult periods during the some negotiations in that chapter in particular. I know myself, working with the Cyprus Academic Dialogue, we delivered a, let's say, our version of a convergence paper on the property. I remember the UN envoy at the time, Alexander Downer, received it and must have given it to you guys. I don't know how you took it. But so, no, that's...
No, it's a very sensitive chapter dealing with human rights as such, which property rights is one of the human rights.
Whilst trying to introduce compromise.
Interconnected also with territory.
Correct.
Because from what we were negotiating, and in fact what we ended up in Gran Montana, for example, with the territory that was going to be released based on what we had come to a very close agreement in Geneva in January of 2017, with the maps that we exchanged, a large part of the territory was going to be returned, and of course, in that territory, property would have been restituted. to the owners. So something like 85,000 or 90,000 owners, but also displaced persons would have returned and have access to their properties. And the rest, of course, I mean, the Guterres framework made some proposals, made some suggestions on how to deal with the property issue. Some find it unjust, but it's one of the compromises that we have to make in order to reach an overall solution.
Yeah,
you cannot have it all in one chapter.
The all or nothing is what we seem to stick on,
so,
unfortunately.
So we have to make some compromises, of course, provided that owners will be fully compensated, fully compensated. Probably they will not have access to the specific property to be returned, but they will be fully... but the most important thing, Costa, is that based on what we were negotiating, people from both sides would have been able not only to move throughout the island, but also to establish themselves and work.
Much like an EU model, freedom
of
movement, work.
And this is the good thing about joining the European Union. And the benefit that we had after joining the European Union, that the acquis, what we call the acquis, which is the laws and legislature of and the treaties of the European Union, have to be applicable to Cyprus as well.
Definitely.
So all these very important principles of freedom of movement, establishment, work, cannot be an exception for Cyprus.
Correct.
So,
so
this is why the convergences that we reached are better than the Annan plan.
That's one only hopes now that we can pick up from where we left off and just finalize it. I mean, one can be optimistic, but it is difficult.
I want to remain optimistic. Mm. I want to, but unfortunately, we lost a lot of time and we lost the leader, Mustafa Akinci.
Yeah.
He was the best ever, compared to all the other Turkish Cypriot leaders, to reach an agreement. Because he was, first and most, he was a Cypriot.
Yes, yes.
And it's so unfortunate that he was not re-elected. And,
we don't know what the future holds. Again, one can only be positive, optimistic. Because if we're pessimistic, then you definitely won't move forward. I mean, we can.
What I cannot accept, Costa, is for my country to remain divided, to consolidate partition. And my background, my family background, coming from lost homelands, you know, the Pontos case. Is deep-rooted in my psyche.
Yes.
So I don't want my country with 10,000 years of history to lose forever a very precious part of our homeland.
And I think also for the Turkish Cypriots, there is so much to gain.
Sure.
So much to gain from a
reunification. That's why they are still fighting. They're still determined.
And look, they fight. I mean, I often say that they're the hardest fighters on the island because they're fighting a double front.
Mm.
I mean, they're trying to deal with the Greek Cypriots, the Republic of Cyprus, and Turkey at the same time. Mm. We face one front as Greek Cypriots. So I think we should underestimate the challenges that they face and good on them.
I have very close contacts with Turkish Cypriots. Mm. And I have been very, very active during the past several years after I left the foreign ministry, joined a lot of initiatives, bicommunal initiatives, still working with a number of bicommunal groups for the Cyprus issue, for cultural issues. We just had a week ago a joint celebration of Greek Cypriot, Turkish Cypriot women, but also women from Maronites, Armenians, and so on. It was the International Day for Women. Mm-hmm. So we had a cultural event because I write poetry also. Mm-hmm. So we poets from both communities and other communities living in Cyprus. So I participate in a lot of cultural, political, social, bicommunal groups because I feel strongly that we have to use every opportunity.
Yes.
That we have to reunite our country.
Right, from the grassroots right to the top. We have to all keep going.
We have to send this message to the leaders that enough is enough after so many years.
Yes.
And I'm saying after 60 years, it's not only 50 years, it's 60 years.
Correct.
Since the division, since the troubles started, and this is not my country.
We all want to live in a normal state.
Yes.
We all want
we
to
live.
We are
not in a normal state
we are
right
not.
Now.
No, no. Yeah. This frozen conflict is too sensitive. It could be a tinderbox. We want to live in a modern European normal state.
Cyprus can be a paradise, really, and a model, and a model, a strong model,
Absolutely.
A strong message to everyone.
It can be an ideal state in a volatile region and can give hope to the region around us.
But we have never understood that. I mean, our leaders.
Let's hope anyone listening can pick up that flame and be inspired by this discussion.
And join, please join groups that work for unification, that work for peace.
And we need to realize that we can take this power to the ballot box.
Yeah.
We have to realize that
we have to remain politically active.
Yes.
Politically active.
Well, look, on that note, I do hope that I do continue to see you for the next decade politically active and civil society active.
Thank you, Costa.
You're an
Thank
absolute
you.
Inspiration. I absolutely love the work you do. I adore you as a person as well. And
Thank
I'm
you,
so grateful that you gave me your time today. And I'm definitely going to have you back in the near future. We're going to have another chat.
Okay.
And because I think we're just getting to some more juicy things now, but we don't have enough time.
Okay.
But watch this space. Era Tokozaku Markuli, thank you so much.
Thank you, Gustavo. Thank you very much for this opportunity to talk with you. Thank you.
The first trilingual podcast station of Cyprus. Island Talks. Open, diverse, free.